Our next case is United States v. Pyron. Lieutenant Horst, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Lieutenant Royal, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Megan Horst, and I represent the appellant, MA2 Adam Pyron. Your Honor, I respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Before his trial started, MA2 Pyron watched the government use a false proffer to retain a biased member on his panel. On rehearing, the military judge protected MA2 Pyron's right to a fair trial by excluding his testimony. This court should affirm the military judge's ruling for 3 reasons. First, he properly considered the evidence before him. Second, he correctly applied Harrison versus United States. And third, he correctly found the government failed to meet its burden. Beginning with the first issue granted by this court, the lower court exceeded the scope of Article 62 review by making a decision based on evidence that was not before the military judge. In United States...
Can we focus on issue 2 first?
Yes, Your Honor.
I hope I'm not throwing you off unduly if I do that to you.
No problem.
So if I may, let me ask you this. Am I oversimplifying things to the point of making it incorrect? If I distill Harrison down to this single solitary sentence, that an accused testimony at a prior trial is admissible at a subsequent trial unless, A, the government engaged in illegal conduct, and B, the government's illegal conduct induced the accused testimony. Is that an oversimplification?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think that is what Harrison stands for. But I don't think that Harrison, when it's applied, requires an illegal government action.
But that's why I'm phrasing that in kind of the stark terms that I did. If illegal conduct is, in fact, the standard, how are you showing illegal conduct here?
We still have illegal conduct here because we have unlawful government action because the government's false proffer caused the constitutional error. So even if the rule requires unlawful action, which I don't believe that it does, Your Honor, if it does, we still have the government causing the constitutional error.
So what is the standard? If it's not illegal / unlawful conduct, how would you characterize the conduct that would satisfy the first prong in Harrison?
Your Honor, I believe it is any constitutional error that results in a rehearing. So Harrison applies, and we've seen state and federal courts do this. Harrison applies when there's a constitutional error that results in a rehearing and the government seeks to use it in a rehearing. And we've seen this rule applied to multiple constitutional violations. For instance, in United States versus Bull, the Second Circuit, Harrison was applied to a Sixth Amendment violation. In United States versus Palello, Harrison was applied to a Fifth Amendment due process violation. And NMCCA applied in United States versus Murray, applied Harrison to an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, so a Sixth Amendment violation. And so...
So, from your perspective then, illegal conduct equals unlawful conduct equals a violation of the constitutional rights of the accused. It's all one continuum, really.
Yes, Your Honor.
So any of those would fit in terms of the first prong of Harrison?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's because there can be other reasons besides unlawful police conduct that causes an accused or impels an accused to testify. And Harrison itself, in footnote 10, talks about how the testimony is not just excluded to deter unlawful police conduct. It's excluded to preserve judicial integrity, to ensure that the accused is getting really the remedy of a rehearing, ensuring that no illegality from that first trial is then passed on to the second trial.
Lieutenant Horst, let's assume, for the sake of my question only, that there is an illegality in the sense that you have described it. I'm still having a little trouble from a logical standpoint, and I admit it could be me. I may not be following the argument. But how is it that, it's still not clear to me how it is that this violation induced the accused to testify for first trial?
The facts that were presented to the military judge included the government's false proffer. So MA2 Pyron saw the government falsely tell the military judge that the member had been rehabilitated. And over defense objection, the military judge believes the government. In addition to that, this particular error, the bias member, the bias that the member had was directly related to the offenses in this case. So the member said, I will hear, when I hear the alleged victims come in to testify, I will be thinking of my daughters, and I thought of them when I saw the charge sheet. So that was the only reason that was presented to the military judge to explain potentially why MA2 Pyron testified.
But then, and then what would be the going through the accused mind to have him decide that he has to go on the witness stand to refute what?
Your Honor, that's exactly what the government needed to show. The government needed to dispel this inference that the defense argued to the military judge and presented to the military judge. And when the military judge turned to the government and said, what evidence do you have to show me that this testimony was unrelated to the bias member on the panel, the government said, we don't have your evidence, Your Honor. It would be difficult to meet the burden under the circumstances. And that's really because of the nature of the error in this case. It was at the very start of trial, and it tainted the entire proceedings. And that's what NMCCA found in their 2021 opinion. And
Counsel,
so,
oh, go ahead. Please finish your sentence.
That's all, Your Honor.
I just wanted to follow up on the Chief Judge's inquiry. Let's suppose that at trial the government seeks to introduce an exhibit. The accused objects on grounds of hearsay, but the exhibit is admitted and it's incriminating. The accused then testifies, and on appeal prevails, and the Court of Criminal Appeals says, look, that exhibit was hearsay, and it should not have been admitted. In that case, would the accused and the accused says, the only reason I testified is because I had to overcome that incriminating exhibit that was wrongly admitted because it was hearsay. Now, it's illegal in the sense it violates the rules of evidence. In that case, would the accused testimony be excluded?
Yes, Your Honor, it would, because it resulted in a rehearing. It wasn't shown to be harmless by the government in this first trial. So now we're looking at the second trial, and Harrison acts as a constitutional check just to ensure that we'll follow the general rule of admissibility, but we need to ensure that we're not bringing that taint from the first trial, like you just described, Your Honor, into the second trial. And it isn't just, you know, the accused saying, here's exactly why I testified. There are other ways that the government can meet its burden. It's not an unworkable rule just because it was difficult in this case.
But how so? Trial counsel essentially raised this point of whether taking the approach you've articulated wouldn't create a strict liability regime here, where there's some constitutional error, because you're equating a constitutional error with illegality under Harrison, and then the military judge says, and first off, the defense counsel says, it was because of that error that my client testified. We can't get into attorney-client conversations and so forth, so we have to accept that at face value. And the trial counsel was trying to articulate to the military judge of, how do I rebut that? So that's the question I pose to you. How do we get out of the sphere of strict liability if there's a constitutional error, simply a constitutional error, accused testifies, accused is convicted, and then on appeal the accused says, you know what, I get a new trial, simply because of something that rises to the level of a constitutional error? How would the government rebut in those types of cases?
Your Honor, we've seen the government meet their burden by looking to the timing of the error. So when did the error occur? Did it occur after the accused chose to testify? Did it accuse before?
That's a pretty tenuous thing, isn't it? Isn't a constitutional violation a constitutional violation?
Yes, Your Honor, but the rehearing is the remedy to the constitutional violation. So as long as we can ensure that the error, that the accused testimony, something that the government didn't have before that first trial, isn't somehow impacted by that illegality, then it can come in.
Are there other factors that we would look at?
Yes, Your Honor. Harrison gives an example. If the government can show that the accused testified only because of the strength of the evidence against him, then that evidence can come in.
So is it then just in all of these cases going forward, if you were to adopt your approach? And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm asking you your view on this, that the defense says constitutional error induced my client's testimony. The government says, Your Honor, we wouldn't even be in this courtroom unless there was compelling evidence that this accused engaged in this misconduct. And then the military judge simply chooses, and the CCA says, well, fits within the range of reasonable choices of the military judge.
Well, Your Honor, we've seen cases like United States versus Palello, where it doesn't have to do with the timing of the error, it doesn't have to do with the strength of the evidence, but the government was able to show exactly why the accused testified, or at least by a preponderance of the evidence why he testified, which was to put on a specific entitlement defense. So they were just, they filtered through the accused testimony, saw that it was completely unrelated to the Brady violation that resulted in the rehearing in the first place, and they were able to admit it in that case. So it's not an unworkable rule in the sense that it requires a case-by-case analysis, but the government in this case didn't even attempt to explain that the member selection issue, as they were calling it, was unrelated. So they could have done that. I mean, I do think it's a difficult burden to meet in this particular case, but Harrison gives them that example. Show why the accused testified. And it only has to be by a preponderance of the evidence.
How is this, so in Harrison, you're saying this all comes from Harrison, but in Harrison, the Supreme Court recognized, right, that the general evidentiary rule that a defendant's testimony at a former trial is admissible in their subsequent trial. How is this, Chief, I think, fairly called this a strict liability regime, consistent with that rule? Why doesn't it swallow the rule? It sounds like the general rule is that it isn't admissible under the way you're describing it.
Your Honor, I think it legitimizes the rule because it focuses on why we are in the rehearing in the first place. It ensures that illegality from the first trial does not bleed into the second trial, and if that means that the accused testimony from the first trial has to be excluded, then it has to be excluded. It's a constitutional check on the rule. It doesn't swallow it, and the government only has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that it's unrelated to the testimony.
But it doesn't, why you seem to be saying that they can't just do that through argument? They can't just do that through common sense. Like there's no reason why this issue with one of the panel members had anything to do with the appellant's decision to testify, and other than his counsel say so now. I mean, how is it, what evidence could they possibly present? Is it just common sense argument, and then it's up to the military judge to decide whose argument is more persuasive?
Your Honor, the military judge can make a reasonable inference based on what's provided to him. So in this case, if the government had provided the original record of trial or some other testimony to show, here's what MA2 Pyron was rebutting when he testified, that would be enough. But we don't have that in this case. The military judge here made a reasonable inference based on what was presented to him. The only reason MA2 Pyron may have testified, the defense didn't even say did testify, they say may have testified based on that false proffer and based on the biased member. And in this particular case, it's not even that, you know, in every voir dire case, if there's, you know, a defense challenge denied and it's unconstitutional or shouldn't have been denied. It's not that even in all those cases, the accused testimony will never be able to come in. You can imagine a situation where an undisclosed bias comes out later and the accused has already testified, then the government would have an easy job there to show, look at the timing of the offense. Look how this occurred.
May I just ask a follow-up based on what you just said, because I'm not sure I understand it. You seem to be viewing it as a plus for your position that here defense counsel said my client may have testified because of the constitutional violation, rather than defense counsel saying did testify because of the constitutional violation. Why does that help your position?
It doesn't help or hurt me, Your Honor, because the defense didn't have to put on any evidence. The burden is never on the government or on the defense, Your Honor, to show why MA2 Pyron testified. But that was the proffer provided by the defense counsel, and that it matters in this case because it's the only thing that the military judge has to work with. He doesn't know what that first trial looked like. He doesn't know why MA2 Pyron testified. And all he knows is that there was government action that caused a constitutional error. It occurred at the start of trial, and it tainted the entire proceedings. That's what the military judge is working with. And the government did not dispel the reasonable inference that he made. You can make a reasonable inference. Harrison talks about what would be the natural inference for why an accused testified, but that just wasn't discussed here at trial.
So in your view, this is all about the burden and the failure of the government to meet its burden.
Yes,
surely.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Because Harrison requires that the testimony be sufficiently distinguishable. So if the government had put on some other evidence to dispel the inference that the military judge was provided, then this may have been a different case.
But there was no finding of fact, I didn't see it at least, from the military judge that appellant's decision to testify in the first court-martial was causally linked to the error, right? Would the military judge need to find that as a finding of fact or for Harrison to apply? Because I don't hear you to be disputing the way the chief characterized the two requirements of Harrison for an appellant's prior testimony to be excluded.
Your Honor, what the military judge found is that the government failed to show their actions from the first trial did not induce the accused testimony. That was the military judge's finding. That's supported by the record. They did not show why MA2.
And was that a finding of fact? Because I didn't see it in the findings of fact, or was it a conclusion of law?
It was included in the conclusions of law section, Your Honor, but it's a mixed question of fact and law, because it's going to whether or not the military or the government met their burden. But the military judge also found that MA2 Pyron testified at least in some part due to the government's false proffer. That finding of fact is also in the conclusions section, but that is the finding of fact that's based on his reasonable inference from the evidence, which he said, I drew reasonable inferences from that evidence. So viewing the light most favorable to MA2 Pyron, these facts support the military judge's finding that the government didn't meet their burden and that MA2 Pyron testified at least in some part due to the error that occurred and changed his entire trial.
More questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Crawford, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Blake Coyle, and along with Colonel Jennings, I represent the United States. This court should affirm for two reasons. First, the CCA properly considered matters that were present in the record. And second, Harrison only applies to situations where the government's use of illegally obtained evidence impelled an appellant's testimony. As for the first issue, we stand on our brief, and I'd like to go directly to the second issue. The general rule is admission of voluntary statements. Harrison is the exception, and this court should not expand it beyond its own terms. Your Honors, the government needs to address, in our original brief at the CCA, we cite Palullo for saying that it did not extend Harrison. Palullo was before the Third Circuit four times, and if you only read the fourth opinion, it's unclear that they actually are extending Palullo in But a deep read in Palullo 3, the 1997 case, it's clear that Palullo is adopting the Harrison framework even for this Brady violation. However, once they do an analysis, they do not apply the exception to Palullo's case. So to the extent that the government miscited Palullo, we need to correct that issue here today. However, Palullo is the minority view. The majority, the significant majority of federal circuits apply Harrison only to a defendant's testimony when a defendant's testimony is impelled by the improper use of his own unconstitutionally obtained confession in violation of the Fifth Amendment. That's a citation from Littlejohn, a Tenth Circuit case. It's been adopted by the Fifth Circuit, Third Circuit. the majority opinion of federal circuits. And there's this court or its predecessor has never extended Harrison beyond the framework of an illegally obtained confession that impels an appellant to testify to explain away his words, which is what we have here.
Counsel, can I ask you a procedural question?
Yes, Your Honor.
At trial, the government's response was very brief when the military judge was addressing this issue, and essentially the government said, well, these things are unrelated, and that was about the extent of the government's argument. The government also said the general rule is that prior testimony is permitted, these things are unrelated, and it would be impossible for the government to meet this burden. Can we consider additional arguments on appeal, arguments that for the government that were not raised before the military judge? For example, the argument that Harrison doesn't apply in this situation.
No, Your Honor. However, I think the United States did not concede that issue. The United States brief and the excerpts of the evidence specifically attached to that motion maintain the entire framework that this is not a Harrison case. The excerpts from the testimony and the excerpts from the interrogation all indicate that his confession to NCIS was a lawful confession, and thus we're not in a Harrison framework. At trial counsel was adopting the evidence was and the argument was directed to Harrison does not apply. We're in the general rule framework. Apart from that, the evidence before the military judge indicates that there's no evidence, as Chief Judge Olson points out. Appellant never even says this is why I testified. That would put the government in a position to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the Harrison exception should not apply. However, we don't even get to the Harrison exception here because we proved that his confession was a lawful confession and it did not induce him to testify at trial. And that reasoning comes from Palullo. Palullo for the case we cite in our briefs spend a great deal of time going through the analysis how you could determine if you were in the Harrison framework. Once the court adopts, hey, we're in a Harrison framework, we have to apply. They look at the testimony of the accused, the state of the evidence, and whether or not what the testimony of the accused is rebutting. Here, the state of the evidence that was before the military judge attached to appellate exhibit, the appellate exhibits on rehearing, appellate exhibit 30, 11, 17, 31, 24, 26, appellate exhibit 17, appellate exhibits 11 and 10 are all of the evidence relied on by the CCA. We have the full transcript and recording of his confession in NCIS. We have the transcript of the forensic interviews of the victims. We have both of the victims' testimonies, the transcripts, transcripts of appellant's testimony, transcripts of the mother's testimony about the immediate outcry. We have the cell phone extraction, and then the DNA results. And if you look at appellant's testimony, it is tailored to rebut his lawful confession to NCIS. It was the trial. It was the at the original trial. It was their whole defense theory. The other witnesses that they were presented were character for truthfulness witnesses to say, you can believe Pyron when he's telling you today what happened. The reason appellant testified from the record is clear, was to rebut his lawful confession. Lawful confession does not get us in a Harrison framework. Yes, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Royal, what about appellate defense counsel's broader reading of Harrison, that it's much broader than what you're in the position you're taking, that it includes a whole array of illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional errors that occur at some point before the accused decides to testify?
Yes, Your Honor. Adopting that framework would swallow the general rule. Harrison, in its own terms, is explicit. They cite Wong Sun for the proposition that we are in an exclusionary rule framework here. And the exclusionary rule is to purge the primary taint of the illegality and to send a strong message to government investigators to follow the rules. Here, an honest mistake, as the CCA found in Pyron 1, there's nothing there's no illegal action, there's nothing to deter, because we have a honest mistake in a complex, day-long voir dire process.
So illegal doesn't necessarily, or in your view, can't be read as broadly as the defense is suggesting?
No, Your Honor. To Judge Hardy's point, it has to have a causal link. Harrison talks about the causal link. The case is tight. It has to be the reason appellant testified. It would be hard. I can't think of a time where a rehearing is ordered that doesn't implicate the Constitution. Even in an evidentiary hearing where you have a hearsay violation which triggers a rehearing, that's ultimately implicates the Confrontation Clause. If the rule is any time we have a rehearing because there's a constitutional issue, I can't think of a time where the government would be able to use a prior testimony from an appellant. Briefly, if I might, if this court were to find that that the CCA overstepped the scope of Article 62 in attaching the record, this court can still affirm because of all of the evidence that were attached to the rehearing record explicitly.
On that issue, if we decide, and I'm not by any means forecasting the court's decision in this case, but if we decide that the testimony should not have been, previous testimony should not have been admitted or was not admissible, do we even have to reach the other issue?
No, Your Honor. This court can pierce through the CCA's decision and just go directly to the heart of the issue.
I didn't mean to throw you off track.
Oh, no, Your Honor. Just to reiterate, the United States' view is that Harrison, on its own terms, and the majority of the circuits, this court's precedent in DeWitt, cabin the Harrison exception specifically to an illegal confession that impels, where there's a direct causal link that impels an appellant's testimony. That's Harrison. This court should not expand Harrison.
So if I can go back to a point you made, I want to make sure that I understand it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Were you saying, and perhaps you weren't, that whatever the facts may be, in the course of this issue being presented to a military judge, a defense counsel has to clearly invoke Harrison, and here they didn't because trial defense counsel, merely said, well, may have induced it. And therefore, the burden really never shifted to the government to rebut that because they didn't say, yes, this constitutional error did induce, but simply said, may have induced.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that there may be a circumstance where the causal link is so clear that it requires no action by an appellant to that the court is clearly in a Harrison framework. If, for example, we have the specific issue in Harrison, a coerced confession, appellant testifies to rebut that coerced confession, then by the record itself, you're plainly in a Harrison framework. Here, nothing in the record indicates that we're in a Harrison framework because the same military judge ruled his confession NCIS admissible. There's no evidence that his confession addressed the bias of a member panel. In fact, his testimony would seem to not address the bias of he describes conduct of young children in a way that a parent of children those age would think was blatantly absurd. His because we're in a framework where there's no indication in the record, the government doesn't need to the government's in this case there's no burden shift to the government to show we're not in Harrison because there's no indication from the record that we are in Harrison.
Lieutenant, just to follow up on the Chief's question. So when the trial counsel in this case said they're just not related, is it the government's position that what he was implicitly saying was this is not a Harrison case?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're not in the Harrison framework at all.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, he could have said that, but I mean, is that essentially what you view the record as him saying?
Yes, Your Honor, and the brief explicitly says that we are not in a Harrison framework. At oral argument on the motion, he could have been more clear, but the government's position is and has always been that we are not in a Harrison framework.
Counsel, does the government have a view about whether or not the military judge's determination about whether the appellant's testimony was impelled by his prior testimony, whether that is a finding of fact or a conclusion of law?
Your Honor, I think that it's a clearly erroneous finding of fact.
And I was going to ask you, and if so, what deference do you believe that determination has on review?
Because the judge's decisions are viewed for abuse of discretion, however, if this court finds that it's clearly erroneous, because he specifically says the court finds some evidence that appellant was induced to testify by the presence of this member. There's no evidence in the record, in the entire record, including Pyron 1, or specifically the record that was attached in the motions litigated. There's no, other than appellate defense or trial defense counsel saying this might have induced him. There's no evidence that he could draw the inference that it did, in fact.
You predicted my next question. I was going to cite that sentence and ask that, you know, they said the defense counsel has provided some evidence. Does the government have any view about what the military judge is referring to in that sentence?
He must be referring to the conditional argument, it might have been, because there's no actual evidence that would tie what we don't have is a colloquy with the first trial judge saying, Your Honor, I'm testifying today because of the presence of this member, or an affidavit from appellant saying, I testified at trial because that member was there and I was concerned that he was biased and I needed to explain away what had happened. There's no any other than the only hint that this is a Harrison framework is trial defense counsel saying, this might be Harrison. Barring any further questions.
Any further questions from the bench?
Yes, sir. I have one question. Now, obviously, going back to the motions hearing at the first trial. Oh, I'm sorry. The rehearing. Not that the accused is required to testify, but could the accused, and I'm asking a question because even though I once upon a time, back in the dark ages, was a trial practitioner, you know, sometimes you forget what you once knew. You know. But anyway, that aside, couldn't the accused have testified solely for the purpose of the motion? Understanding he doesn't have to and it's not the defense burden at all, but could he have? Just out of curiosity. Indulge my curiosity.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant could certainly have testified for the limited purpose of the 39A, and if this court were to adopt the minority approach to Harrison, that expands it to government action that impels an appellant's testimony, then that limited scope, that testimony for the limited scope of the hearing would push us into the expanded Harrison framework, and the government would have a burden by preponderance of the evidence to show that.
So that would be something that would shift the burden in the context of the Chief Judge's earlier question.
Yes, Your Honor, if this court
not shift it, but impose the burden on you.
Yes, if this court were to adopt the minority view that Harrison applies not just to coerced confessions, but to other illegal acts or other illegal evidence. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chief.
Additional questions? Thank you, Lieutenant Royal. Lieutenant Horace. Lieutenant, I don't want to hijack your time. Please, you can move the timer for you. But could you please address the government's point that this case was never in the Harrison framework, and that's what the trial counsel was indicating to the military judge?
Yes, Your Honor. Harrison was cited in the government's motion to admit this testimony. The government cited Harrison because it is relevant to the issue. The government argued that Harrison didn't apply, but in arguing that, applied Harrison to ensure that the accused testimony was not tainted by the illegality of the first trial. It's not a minority position that Harrison applies outside of the constitutional violation in Harrison. And we've seen that in the cases.
Is it the minority view that it does not apply if there's no causal link?
No, Your Honor. There does need to be a causal link, but the burden is on the government to show that causal link.
And when does that burden get imposed? Is it any time the government wants to use a defendant's testimony from a prior trial, or is there some threshold that has to be crossed before that burden gets imposed on the government?
The burden is imposed on the government when they want to admit an accused testimony if there has been a constitutional violation or a violation that resulted in a rehearing. Because it's at that moment
Does there have to be a constitutional violation, or can there be any violation that requires a rehearing?
What we see in the cases that apply Harrison, it's a constitutional violation. Because you can see in United States versus Nell, that's the closest case that we have to a voir dire error. There was the defense was forced to use peremptory challenges in that case. And Harrison wouldn't apply in that situation because there is no constitutional right to a peremptory challenge. And so it's the rule is that Harrison is triggered when there's a constitutional violation that results in a rehearing, and the government seeks to use it as evidence at the rehearing.
Even when there's no illegal action on behalf of the prosecution?
Yes, Your Honor, based on what we've seen in the state and district courses. And based on what we see in United States versus Murray, the ineffective assistance of counsel case that applies this as well.
I know we've used up your time. May I ask more?
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask you the same question I asked the government, which is, do you have a view on what the military judge is referring to when he says the defense has provided some evidence to the court that the accused did testify at his first trial due in some part to the error?
Yes, Your Honor. My view is that the military judge was relying on the government's false proffer, the impact that had on MA2 Pyron, and the specific bias of the member, which is that he was going to think of his two daughters when the alleged victims came out to testify. That, in that moment, the reasonable inference was that MA2 Pyron felt required to participate in his trial, not just sit back and let it play out, but become to get up on the stand and try to convince that member, talking to that member as a dad, that that he did not commit these crimes. That's the reasonable inference that the military judge is making, and that's the finding of fact, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.
I was a little concerned. Crawford brought in an old MCM. So. Oh, no.